of his sons. He ought to run them away from home, no matter how big they are. And if he can't do that, I be durned if he oughtn't to leave himself. I be durned if I wouldn't. You mean you tried to swap my horse? Jules says. Aunt stands there, dangle-armed. For 15 years I ain't had a tooth in my head, he says. God knows it. He knows in 15 years I ain't et the vittles he aimed for man to eat to keep his strength up. And me saving a nickel here and a nickel there so my family wouldn't suffer it, to buy them teeth so I could eat God's appointed food. I give that money. I thought that if I could do without eating, my sons could do without riding. God knows I did. Jules stands with his hands on his hips, looking at Ants. Then he looks away. He looked out across the field, his face still as a rock, like it was somebody else talking about somebody else's horse and him not even listening. Then he spit, slow, and said, "Hell." And he turned and went on to the gate and unhitched the horse and got on it. It was moving when he come into the saddle. By the time he was on it, they was tearing down the road like the law might have been behind them. They went out of sight that way, the two of them looking like some kind of a spotted cyclone. "Well," I says, "you take my team," I said. But he wouldn't do it. And they wouldn't even stay. And that boy chasing them buzzards all day in the hot sun until he was nigh as crazy as the rest of them. "Leave cash here anyway," I said. But they wouldn't do that. They made a pallet for him with quilts on top of the coffin and laid him on it and set his tools by him. And we put my team in and hauled the wagon about a mile down the road. "If we'll bother you here," Aunt says, "just say so." "Sure," I said. "It'll be fine here. Safe, too. Now let's go back and eat supper." "I thank you," Aunt said. "We got a little something in the basket. We can make out." "Where'd you get it?" I said. "We brought it from home." "But it'll be stale now," I said. "Come and get some hot vittles." But they wouldn't come. "I reckon we can make out," Aunt said. So I went home and ate and taken a basket back to them and tried again to make them come back to the house. "I thank you," he said. "I reckon we can make out." So I left them there, squatting around a little fire waiting. God knows what for. I come on home. I kept thinking about them there and about that fellow tearing away on that horse. And that would be the last they would see of him. And I'd be durned if I could blame him. Not for wanting to not give up his horse, but for getting shut of such a durn fool as Ants. Or that's what I thought then. Because be it durn if there ain't something about a durn fella like Ants that seems to make a man have to help him, even when he knows he'll be wanting to kick himself next minute. Because about an hour after breakfast next morning, Eustace Grimm that works Snope's place come up with a span of mules, hunting Ants. "I thought him and Ants never traded," I said.
"Sure," Eustace said. "All they liked was the horse. Like I said to Mr. Snopes, he was letting this team go for $50, because if his Uncle Flem had just kept them Texas horses when he owned them, Ants wouldn't have never..."
"The horse?" I said. "Ants's boy taken that horse and cleared out last night. Probably halfway to Texas by now, and Ants..."
"I didn't know who brung it," Eustace said. "I never see them. I just found the horse in the barn this morning when I went to feed, and I told Mr. Snopes, and he said to bring the team on over here."
"Well," That'll be the last they'll ever see of him now, sure enough. Come Christmas time, they'll maybe get a postal card from him in Texas, I reckon. And if it hadn't have been Jewel, I reckoned it'd have been me. I owe him that much myself. I'll be darned if ants don't conjure a man some way. I'll be darned if he ain't a sight.
Vardaman. Now there are seven of them in little tall black circles. Look, Dar, I say. See? He looks up. We watch them in little tall black circles of not moving. Yesterday there were just four, I say. There were more than four on the barn. Do you know what I would do if he tries to light on the wagon again? I say. What would you do? Dar says. I wouldn't let him light on her, I say. I wouldn't let him light on Cash either. Cash is sick. He is sick on the box. But my mother is a fish.
We got to get some medicine in Motson, Pa says. I reckon we'll just have to.
How do you feel, Cash? Dar says.
It don't bother none, Cash says. Do you want it propped a little higher? Dar says.
Cash has a broken leg. He has had two broken legs. He lies on the box with a quilt rolled under his head and a piece of wood under his knee.
I reckon we ought to left him at Armstead's, Pa says.
I haven't got a broken leg, and Pa hasn't, and Darl hasn't, and
it's just the bumps, Cash says. It kind of grinds together a little on a bump. It don't bother none.
Jewel has gone away. He and his horse went away one supper time.
It's because she wouldn't have us beholden, Pa says. For God, I do the best that e'er a man.
Is it because Jewel's mother is a horse, Dar? I said.
Maybe I can draw the ropes a little tighter, Dar says.
That's why Jewel and I were both in the shed, and she was in the wagon, because the horse lives in the barn, and I had to keep on running the buzzard away from.
If you just would, Cash says. And Dewey Dell hasn't got a broken leg, and I haven't. Cash is my brother. We stop. When Dar loosens the rope, Cash begins to sweat again. His teeth look out.
Hurt? Dar says.
I reckon you better put it back, Cash says.
Dar puts the rope back, pulling hard. Cash's teeth look out. Hurt? Dar says.
It don't bother none, Cash says.
Do you want Pa to drive slower? Dar says. No, Cash says. Ain't no time to hang back. It don't bother none.
We'll have to get some medicine at Motson, Pa says. I reckon we'll have to.
Tell him to go on, Cash says. We go on. Dewey Dell leans back and wipes Cash's face. Cash is my brother.
But Jewel's mother is a horse. My mother is a fish.
Dahl says that when we come to the water again, I might see her. And Dewey Dell said, she's in the box. How could she have got out? She got out through the holes I bored. Into the water, I said, and when we come to the water again, I am going to see her. My mother is not in the box. My mother does not smell like that. My mother is a fish.
Those cakes will be in fine shape by the time we get to Jefferson, Dar says.
Dewey Dell does not look around.
You better try to sell them in Motson, Darl says.
When will we get to Motson, Darl?
I say. Tomorrow, Darl says. If this team don't rack to pieces, Snopes must have fed them on sawdust.
Why did he feed them on sawdust, Darl? I say.
Look, Darl says. See?
Now there are 9 of them, tall in little tall black circles. When we come to the foot of the hill, Pa stops and Darl and Dewey Dell and I get out. Cash can't walk because he has a broken leg.
Come up, mules,
Pa says. The mules walk hard. The wagon creaks. Darl and Dewey Dell and I walk behind the wagon up the hill. When we come to the top of the hill, Pa stops and we get back into the wagon. Now there are 10 of them, tall in little tall black circles on the sky.
Mosley. I happened to look up and saw outside the window, looking in. Not close to the glass and not looking at anything in particular. Just standing there with her head turned this way and her eyes full on me and kind of blank, too, like she was waiting for a sign. When I looked up again, she was moving toward the door. She kind of bumbled at the screen door a minute, like they do, and came in. She had on a stiff-brimmed straw hat sitting on the top of her head, and she was carrying a package wrapped in newspaper. I thought that she had a quarter or a dollar at the most, and that after she stood around a while, she'd maybe buy a cheap comb or a bottle of nigger toilet water, so I never disturbed her for a minute or so except to notice that she was pretty in a kind of sullen, awkward way, and that she looked a sight better in her gingham dress and her own complexion than she would after she bought whatever she would finally decide on, or tell that she wanted. I knew that she had already decided before she came in. But you have to let them take their time. So I went on with what I was doing, figuring to let Albert wait on her when he caught up at the fountain, when he came back to me.
That woman, he said, you better see what she wants.
What does she want? I said.
I don't know. I can't get anything out of her. You better wait on her.
So I went around the counter. I saw that she was barefooted, standing with her feet flat and easy on the floor, like she was used to it. She was looking at me hard, holding the package. I saw she had about as black a pair of eyes as ever I saw, and she was a stranger. I never remembered seeing her in Motson before. What can I do for you? I said. Still, she didn't say anything. She stared at me without winking. Then she looked back at the folks at the fountain. Then she looked past me, toward the back of the store. Do you want to look at some toilet things? I said. Or is it medicine you want?
That's it, she said.
She looked quick back at the fountain again. So I thought maybe her ma or somebody had sent her in for some of this female dope and she was ashamed to ask for it. I knew she couldn't have a complexion like hers and use it herself, let alone not being much more than old enough to barely know what it was for. It's a shame, the way they poison themselves with it. But a man's got to stock it or go out of business in this country. Oh, I said, what do you use? We have... She looked at me again, almost like she had said hush, and looked toward the back of the store again.
I'd liefer go back there, she said.
All right, I said. You have to humor them. You save time by it. I followed her to the back. She put a hand on the gate. "There's nothing back there but the prescription case," I said. "What do you want?" She stopped and looked at me. It was like she had taken some kind of a lid off her face, her eyes. It was her eyes, kind of dumb and hopeful and sullenly willing to be disappointed all at the same time. But she was in trouble of some sort. I could see that. "What's your trouble?" I said. "Tell me what it is you want. I'm pretty busy." I wasn't meaning to hurry her, but a man just hasn't got the time they have out there.
"It's the female trouble," she said.
"Oh," I said, "is that all?" I thought maybe she was younger than she looked, and her first one had scared her, or maybe one had been a little abnormal, as it will in young women. "Where's your ma?" I said. "Haven't you got one?"
"She's out yonder in the wagon," she said.
"Why not talk to her about it before you take any medicine?" I said. "Any woman would have told you about it." She looked at me, and I looked at her again and said, "How old are you?"
17,
she said. "Oh," I said, "I thought maybe you were..." She was watching me. But then in the eyes, all of them looked like they had no age and knew everything in the world anyhow. "Are you too regular or not regular enough?" She quit looking at me, but she didn't move.
"Yes," she said. "I reckon so. Yes."
"Well, which?" I said. "Don't you know?" "It's a crime and a shame. But after all, they'll buy it from somebody." She stood there, not looking at me. "You want something to stop it?" I said. "Is that it?"
"No,"
she said.
"That's it. It's already stopped."
"Well, what?" Her face was lowered a little still, like they do in all their dealings with a man so he don't ever know just where the lightning will strike next. "You're not married, are you?" I said.
"No."
"Oh," I said. "And how long has it been since it stopped? About 5 months, maybe?"
"It ain't been but 2, she said.
"Well, I haven't got anything in my store you want to buy," I said, "unless it's a nipple. And I'd advise you to buy that and go back home and tell your pa, if you have one, and let him make somebody buy you a wedding license. Was that all you wanted?" But she just stood there, not looking at me.
"I got the money to pay you," she said.
"Is it your own? Or did he act enough of a man to give you the money?"
"He gave it to me. $10. He said that would be enough."
$1,000 wouldn't be enough in my store, and 10 cents wouldn't be enough," I said. "You take my advice and go home and tell your pa or your brothers if you have any, or the first man you come to in the road." But she didn't move.
"Leif said I could get it at the drugstore. He said to tell you me and him wouldn't never tell nobody you sold it to us."
"And I just wish your precious Leif had come forward himself. That's what I wish. I don't know. I'd have had a little respect for him then. And you can go back and tell him I said so, if he ain't halfway to Texas by now, which I don't doubt. Me, a respectable druggist that's kept store and raised a family and been a church member for 56 years in this town. I'm a good mind to tell your folks myself, if I can just find who they are." She looked at me now, her eyes and face kind of blank again, like when I first saw her through the window.
"I didn't know," she said. "He told me I could get something at the drugstore. He said they might not want to sell it to me, but if I had $10 and told them I wouldn't never tell nobody,
He never said this drugstore, I said. If he did or mentioned my name, I defy him to prove it. I defy him to repeat it, or I'll prosecute him to the full extent of the law, and you can tell him so.
But maybe another drugstore would, she said.
Then I don't want to know it. Me, that's... Then I looked at her. But it's a hard life they have. Sometimes a man... If there can ever be any excuse for sin, which it can't be. And then, life wasn't made to be easy on folks. They wouldn't ever have any reason to be good and die. Look here, I said. You get that notion out of your head. The Lord gave you what you have, even if he did use the devil to do it. You let him take it away from you if it's his will to do so. You go on back to Leif, and you and him take that $10 and get married with it.
Leif said I could get something at the drugstore, she said.
Then go and get it, I said. You won't get it here. She went out, carrying the package, her feet making a little hissing on the floor. She bumbled again at the door and went out. I could see her through the glass going on down the street. It was Albert told me about the rest of it. He said the wagon was stopped in front of Grummet's hardware store, with the ladies all scattering up and down the street with handkerchiefs to their noses, and a crowd of hard-nosed men and boys standing around the wagon, listening to the marshal arguing with the man. He was a kind of tall, gaunted man sitting on the wagon, saying it was a public street and he reckoned he had as much right there as anybody, and the marshal telling him he would have to move on. Folks couldn't stand it. It had been dead 8 days, Albert said. They came from someplace out in Yocnapatawpha County, trying to get to Jefferson with it. It must have been like a piece of rotten cheese coming into an anthill. In that ramshackle wagon that Albert said folks were scared would fall all to pieces before they could get it out of town, with that homemade box and another fellow with a broken leg lying on a quilt on top of it, and the father and a little boy sitting on the seat and the marshal trying to make them get out of town.
It's a public street, the man says. I reckon we can stop to buy something same as every other man. We got the money to pay for it, and it ain't every law that says a man can't spend his money where he wants.
They had stopped to buy some cement. The other son was in Grummet's, trying to make Grummet break a sack and let him have 10 cents worth, and finally Grummet broke the sack to get him out. They wanted the cement to fix the fellow's broken leg some way.
Why, you'll kill him, the marshal said. You'll cause him to lose his leg. You take him on to a doctor, and you get this thing buried soon as you can. Don't you know you're liable to jail for endangering the public health?
We're doing the best we can, the father said. Then he told a long tale about how they had to wait for the wagon to come back, and how the bridge was washed away, and how they went 8 miles to another bridge and it was gone too, so they came back and swum the ford and the mules got drowned, and how they got another team and found that the road was washed out and they had to come clean around by Motson, and then the one with the cement came back and told him to shut up.
We'll be gone in a minute, he told the marshal. We never aimed to bother nobody, the father said.
You take that fella to a doctor, the marshal told the one with the cement.
I reckon he's all right, he said.
It ain't that we're hard-hearted, the marshal said, but I reckon you can tell yourself how it is.
Sure, the other said. We'll take her out soon as Dewey Dell comes back. She went to deliver a package.
So they stood there with the folks backed off with handkerchiefs to their faces, until in a minute the girl came up with that newspaper package. "Come on," the one with the cement said. "We've lost too much time." So they got in the wagon and went on. And when I went to supper, it still seemed like I could smell it. And the next day I met the marshal, and I began to sniff and said, "Smell anything?" "I reckon they're in Jefferson by now," he said. "Or in jail. Well, thank the Lord it's not our jail." "That's a fact," he said.
Darl. "Here's a place," Pa says. He pulls the team up and sits looking at the house. "We could get some water over yonder." "All right," I say. "You'll have to borrow a bucket from them, Dewey Dell." "God knows," Pa says. "I wouldn't be beholden. God knows." "If you see a good-sized can, you might bring it," I say. Dewey Dell gets down from the wagon, carrying the package. "You had more trouble than you expected selling those cakes in Motson," I say. How do our lives ravel out into the no wind, no sound, the weary gestures, wearily recapitulant? Echoes of old compulsions with no hand on no strings. In sunset, we fall into furious attitudes, dead gestures of dolls. Cash broke his leg, and now the sawdust is running out. He is bleeding to death, is Cash. "I wouldn't be beholden," Pa says. "God knows." "Then make some water yourself," I say. "We can use Cash's hat." When Dewey Dell comes back, the man comes with her. Then he stops, and she comes on, and he stands there, and after a while he goes back to the house and stands on the porch, watching us. "We better not try to lift him down," Pa says. "We can fix it here." "Do you want to be lifted down, Cash?" I say. "Won't we get to Jefferson tomorrow?" he says. He is watching us, his eyes interrogatory, intent, and sad. "I can last it out." "It'll be easier on you," Pa says. "It'll keep it from rubbing together." "I can last it," Cash says. "We'll lose time stopping." "We done bought the cement now," Pa says. "I could last it," Cash says. "It ain't but one more day. It don't bother to speak of." He looks at us, his eyes wide in his thin gray face, questioning. "It sets up so," he says. "We done bought it now," Pa says. I mix the cement in the can, stirring the slow water into the pale green thick coils. I bring the can to the wagon where Cash can see. He lies on his back, his thin profile in silhouette, ascetic and profound against the sky. "Does that look about right?" I say. "You don't want too much water, or it won't work right," he says. "Is this too much?" "Maybe if you could get a little sand," he says. "It ain't but one more day," he says. "It don't bother me none." Vardaman goes back down the road to where we cross the branch and returns with sand. He pours it slowly into the thick coiling in the can. I go to the wagon again. "Does that look all right?" "Yes," Cash says. "I could have lasted. It don't bother me none." We loosen the splints and pour the cement over his leg slow. "Watch out for it," Cash says. "Don't get none on it if you can help." "Yes," I say. Dewey Dell tears a piece of paper from the package and wipes the cement from the top of it as it drips from Cash's leg. "How does that feel?" "It feels fine," he says. "It's cold. It feels fine." "If it'll just help you," Pa says, I asks your forgiveness. I never foreseen it no more than you.
It feels fine, Cash says.
If you could just ravel out into time, that would be nice. It would be nice if you could just ravel out into time. We replace the splints, the cords, drawing them tight, the cement in thick, pale green slow surges among the cords, Cash watching us quietly with that profound, questioning look.
That'll steady it, I say.
Aye, Cash says.
I'm obliged.
Then we all turn on the wagon and watch him. He is coming up the road behind us, wooden-backed, wooden-faced, moving only from his hips down. He comes up without a word, with his pale, rigid eyes in his high, sullen face, and gets into the wagon.
Here's a hill, Pa says. I reckon you'll have to get out and walk.
Vardaman. Darl and Jewel and Dewey Dell and I are walking up the hill behind the wagon. Jewel came back. He came up the road and got into the wagon. He was walking. Jewel hasn't got a horse anymore. Jewel is my brother. Cash is my brother. Cash has a broken leg. We fixed Cash's leg so it doesn't hurt. Cash is my brother. Jewel is my brother, too, but he hasn't got a broken leg. Now there are five of them, tall in little tall black circles. Where do they stay at night, Darl? I say. When we stop at night in the barn, where do they stay? The hill goes off into the sky. Then the sun comes up from behind the hill, and the mules and the wagon and Pa walk on the sun. You cannot watch them walking slow on the sun. In Jefferson, it is red on the track behind the glass. The track goes shining round and round. Dewey Dell says so. Tonight, I'm going to see where they stay while we are in the barn.
Darl. Jewel, I say, whose son are you? The breeze was setting up from the barn, so we put her under the apple tree, where the moonlight can dapple the apple tree upon the long, slumbering flanks within which now and then she talks in little trickling bursts of secret and murmurous bubbling. I took Vardaman to listen. When we came up, the cat leaped down from it and flicked away with silver claw and silver eye into the shadow.
Your mother was a horse, but who was your father, Jewel?
You goddamn lying son of a bitch.
Don't call me that, I say.
You goddamn lying son of a bitch.
Don't you call me that, Jewel.
In the tall moonlight, his eyes look like spots of white paper pasted on a high, small football. After supper, Cash began to sweat a little.
It's getting a little hot, he said. It was the sun shining on it all day, I reckon.
You want some water poured on it? We say. Maybe that will ease it some.
I'd be obliged, Cash said. It was the sun shining on it, I reckon. I ought to thought and kept it covered.
We ought to thought, we said. You couldn't have suspicioned.
I never noticed it getting hot, Cash said. I ought to minded it.
So we poured the water over it. His leg and foot below the cement looked like they had been boiled.
Does that feel better? We said.
I'm obliged, Cash said. It feels fine.
Dewey Dell wipes his face with the hem of her dress.
See if you can get some sleep, we say. Show, Cash says. I'm right obliged. It feels fine now.
Jewel,
I say. Who was your father, Jewel? God damn you. God damn you.
Vardaman. She was under the apple tree, and Dahl and I go across the moon, and the cat jumps down and runs, and we can hear her inside the wood. Here, Dahl says, put your ear close. I put my ear close, and I can hear her. Only I can't tell what she's saying. What is she saying, Dahl? I say. Who is she talking to? She's talking to God, Dahl says. She's calling on him to help her. What does she want him to do? I say. She wants him to hide her away from the sight of man, Dahl says. Why does she want to hide her away from the sight of man, Dahl? So she can lay down her life, Dahl says. Why does she want to lay down her life, Dahl? Listen, Dahl says. We hear her. We hear her turn over on her side. Listen, Dahl says. She's turned over, I say. She's looking at me through the wood. Yes, Dahl says. How can she see through the wood, Dahl? Come, Dahl says. We must let her be quiet. Come. She can't see out there because the holes are in the top, I say. How can she see, Dahl? Let's go see about Cash, Dahl says. And I saw something Dewey Dell told me not to tell nobody. Cash is sick in his leg. We fixed his leg this afternoon, but he is sick in it again, lying on the bed. We pour water on his leg, and then he feels fine. I feel fine, Cash says. I'm obliged to you. Try to get some sleep, we say. I feel fine, Cash says. I'm obliged to you. And I saw something Dewey Dell told me not to tell nobody. It is not about Pa, and it is not about Cash, and it is not about Jewel, and it is not about Dewey Dell, and it is not about me. Dewey Dell and I are going to sleep on the pallet. It is on the back porch where we can see the barn, and the moon shines on half of the pallet, and we will lie half in the white and half in the black, with the moonlight on our legs. And then I'm going to see where they stay at night while we are in the barn. We are not in the barn tonight, but I can see the barn, and so I am going to find where they stay at night. We lie on the pallet, with our legs in the moon. Look, I say, my legs look black. Your legs look black, too. Go to sleep, Dewey Dell says. Jefferson is a far piece. Dewey Dell? What? If it's not Christmas now, how will it be there? It goes round and round on the shining track. Then the track goes shining round and round. Will what be there? That train in the window. You go to sleep. You can see tomorrow if it's there. Maybe Santa Claus won't know they are town boys. Dewey Dell? You go to sleep. He ain't going to let none of them town boys have it. It was behind the window, red on the track shining round and round. It made my heart hurt. And then it was Pa and Jewel and Dahl and Mr. Gillespie's boy. Mr. Gillespie's boy's legs come down under his nightshirt. When he goes into the moon, his legs fuzz. They go on around the house toward the apple tree. What are they going to do, Dewey Dell? They went around the house toward the apple tree. I can smell her, I say. Can you smell her too? Hush, Dewey Dell says. The wind's changed. Go to sleep. And so I'm going to know where they stay at night soon. They come around the house, going across the yard in the moon, carrying her on their shoulders. They carry her down to the barn, the moon shining flat and quiet on her. Then they come back and go into the house again. While they were in the moon, Mr. Gillespie's boy's leg fuzzed. And then I waited, and I said, Dewey Dell? And then I waited, and then I went to find where they stay at night. And I saw something that Dewey Dell told me not to tell nobody.
End of Disc 5, Disc 6.
Darl. Against the dark doorway, he seems to materialize out of darkness, lean as a racehorse in his underclothes in the beginning of the glare. He leaps to the ground, with on his face an expression of furious unbelief. He has seen me without even turning his head or his eyes, in which the glare swims like two small torches. Come on, he says, leaping down the slope toward the barn. For an instant longer, he runs silver in the moonlight. Then he springs out like a flat figure cut leanly from tin against an abrupt and soundless explosion as the whole loft of the barn takes fire at once, as though it had been stuffed with powder. The front, the conical facade with the square orifice of doorway broken only by the square squat shape of the coffin on the sawhorses like a cubistic bug, comes into relief. Behind me, Pa and Gillespie and Mac and Dewey Dell and Vardaman emerge from the house. He pauses at the coffin, stooping, looking at me, his face furious. Overhead, the flames sound like thunder. Across us rushes a cool draft. There is no heat in it at all yet. And a handful of chaff lifts suddenly and sucks swiftly along the stalls where a horse is screaming. Quick, I say. The horses! He glares a moment longer at me, then at the roof overhead. Then he leaps toward the stall where the horse screams. It plunges and kicks, the sound of the crashing blows sucking up into the sound of the flames. They sound like an interminable train crossing an endless trestle. Gillespie and Mac pass me, in knee-length nightshirts, shouting, their voices thin and high and meaningless. And at the same time profoundly wild and sad. Cow! Stall! Gillespie's nightshirt rushes ahead of him on the draft, ballooning about his hairy thighs. The stall door is swung shut. Jewel thrusts it back with his buttocks, and he appears, his back arched, the muscles ridged through his garments as he drags the horse out by its head. In the glare, its eyes roll with soft, fleet, wild, opaline fire. Its muscles bunch and run as it flings its head about, lifting Jewel clear of the ground. He drags it on, slowly, terrifically. Again he gives me across the shoulder a single glare, furious and brief. Even when they are clear of the barn, the horse continues to fight and lash backward toward the doorway until Gillespie passes me, stark naked, his nightshirt wrapped about the mule's head, and beats the maddened horse on out of the door. Jewel returns, running. Again he looks down at the coffin, but he comes on. Where's Cow? He cries, passing me. I follow him. In the stall, Mac is struggling with the other mule. When its head turns into the glare, I can see the wild rolling of its eye, too, but it makes no sound. It just stands there, watching Mac over its shoulder, swinging its hindquarters toward him whenever he approaches. He looks back at us, his eyes and mouth three round holes in his face on which the freckles look like English peas on a plate. His voice is thin, high, far away.
I can't do nothing.
It is as though the sound had been swept from his lips and up and away, speaking back to us from an immense distance of exhaustion. Jewel slides past us. The mule whirls and lashes out, but he has already gained its head. I lean to Mac's ear.
Nightshirt, around his head.
Mac stares at me. Then he rips the nightshirt off and flings it over the mule's head, and it becomes docile at once. Jewel is yelling at him.
Cow! Cow!
Back!
Mac cries.
Last stall!
The cow watches us as we enter. She is backed into the corner, head lowered, still chewing, though rapidly. But she makes no move. Jewel has paused, looking up, and suddenly we watch the entire floor to the loft dissolve. It just turns to fire. A faint litter of sparks rains down. He glances about. Back under the trough is a three-legged milking stool. He catches it up and swings it into the planking of the rear wall. He splinters a plank, then another, a third. We tear the fragments away. While we are stooping to the opening, something charges into us from behind. It is the cow. With a single whistling breath, she rushes between us and through the gap and into the outer glare, her tail erect and rigid as a broom nailed upright to the end of her spine. Jewel turns back into the barn.
Here, I say. Jewel!
I grasp at him. He strikes my hand down.
You fool, I say. Don't you see you can't make it back yonder?
The hallway looks like a searchlight turned into rain.
Come on, I say. Around this way.
When we are through the gap, he begins to run.
Jewel,
I say, running. He darts around the corner. When I reach it, he has almost reached the next one, running against the glare like that figure cut from tin. Pa and Gillespie and Mac are some distance away, watching the barn, pink against the darkness, where for the time the moonlight has been vanquished.
Catch him, I cry. Stop him!
When I reach the front, he is struggling with Gillespie, the one lean in underclothes, the other stark naked. They are like two figures in a Greek frieze, isolated out of all reality by the red glare. Before I can reach them, he has struck Gillespie to the ground and turned and run back into the barn. The sound of it has become quite peaceful now, like the sound of the river did. We watch through the dissolving proscenium of the doorway as Jewel runs crouching to the far end of the coffin and stoops to it. For an instant, he looks up and out at us through the rain of burning hay like a portiere of flaming beads, and I can see his mouth shape as he calls my name.
Jewel!
Dewey Dell cries.
Jewel!
It seems to me that I now hear the accumulation of her voice through the last 5 minutes, and I hear her scuffling and struggling as Pa and Mac hold her, screaming,
Jewel! Jewel!
But he is no longer looking at us. We see his shoulders strain as he upends the coffin and slides it single-handed from the sawhorses. It looms unbelievably tall, hiding him. I would not have believed that Addie Bundren would have needed that much room to lie comfortable in. For another instant, it stands upright, while the sparks rain on it in scattering bursts as though they engendered other sparks from the contact. Then it topples forward, gaining momentum, revealing Jewel, and the sparks raining on him too in engendering gusts, so that he appears to be enclosed in a thin nimbus of fire. Without stopping, it overends and rears again, pauses, then crashes slowly forward and through the curtain. This time Jewel is riding upon it, clinging to it, until it crashes down and flings him forward and clear, and Mac leaps forward into a thin smell of scorching meat and slaps at the widening crimson-edged holes that bloom like flowers in his undershirt.
Vardaman. When I went to find where they stay at night, I saw something. They said, "Where's Dahl? Where did Dahl go?" They carried her back under the apple tree. The barn was still red, but it wasn't a barn now. It was sunk down, and the red went swirling up. The barn went swirling up in little red pieces against the sky and the stars so that the stars moved backward. And then Cash was still awake. He turned his head from side to side with sweat on his face. "Do you want some more water on it, Cash?" Dewey Dale said. Cash's leg and foot turned black. We held the lamp and looked at Cash's foot and leg where it was black. "Your foot looks like a nigger's foot, Cash," I said.
"I reckon we'll have to bust it off," Pa said. "What in the tarnation you put it on there for?"
Mr. Gillespie said.
"I thought it would steady it some," Pa said. "I just aimed to help him."
They got the flat iron and the hammer. Dewey Dell held the lamp. They had to hit it hard. And then Cash went to sleep. "He's asleep now," I said. "It can't hurt him while he's asleep." It just cracked. It wouldn't come off.
"It'll take the hide, too," Mr. Gillespie said. "Why in the tarnation you put it on there? Didn't none of you think to grease his leg first?" "I just aimed to help him," Pa said. "It was Dahl put it on."
"Where is Dahl?" they said.
"Didn't none of you have more sense than that?" Mr. Gillespie said. "I'd have thought he would, anyway."
Jewel was lying on his face. His back was red. Dewey Dell put the medicine on it. The medicine was made out of butter and soot to draw out the fire. Then his back was black. "Does it hurt, Jewel?" I said. "Your back looks like a nigger's, Jewel," I said. "Cash's foot and leg look like a nigger's. Then they broke it off. Cash's leg bled." "You go on back and lay down," Dewey Dell said. "You ought to be asleep." "Where is Dahl?" they said. "He is out there under the apple tree with her, lying on her. He is there so the cat won't come back." I said, "Are you going to keep the cat away, Dahl?" The moonlight dappled on him, too. On her it was still, but on Dahl it dappled up and down. "You needn't to cry," I said. "Jewel got her out. You needn't to cry, Dahl." The barn is still red. It used to be redder than this. Then it went swirling, making the stars run backward without falling. It hurt my heart like the train did. When I went to find where they stay at night, I saw something that Dewey Dell says I mustn't tell nobody.
Dahl. We have been passing the signs for some time now. The drug stores, the clothing stores, the patent medicine in the garages and cafes, and the mile boards diminishing, becoming more starkly reoccurrent. 3 miles. 2 miles. From the crest of a hill, as we get into the wagon again, we can see the smoke low and flat, seemingly unmoving in the unwinded afternoon.
"Is that it, Dahl?" Vardaman says. "Is that Jefferson?"
He too has lost flesh. Like ours, his face has an expression strained, dreamy, and gaunt. "Yes," I say. He lifts his head and looks at the sky. High against it, they hang in narrowing circles, like the smoke, with an outward semblance of form and purpose, but with no inference of motion, progress, or retrograde. We mount the wagon again where Cash lies on the box, the jagged shards of cement cracked about his leg. The shabby mules droop, rattling and clanking down the hill.
"We'll have to take him to the doctor," Pa says. "I reckon it ain't no way around it."
The back of Jewel's shirt, where it touches him, stains slow and black with grease. Life was created in the valleys. It blew up onto the hills on the old terrors, the old lusts, the old despairs. That's why you must walk up the hills, so you can ride down. Dewey Dell sits on the seat, the newspaper package on her lap. When we reach the foot of the hill where the road flattens between close walls of trees, she begins to look about quietly from one side of the road to the other. At last, she says,
"I got to stop."
Pa looks at her, his shabby profile that of anticipant and disgruntled annoyance. He does not check the team.
"What for?"
"I got to go to the bushes," Dewey Dell says. Pa does not check the team.
"Can't you wait till we get to town? It ain't over a mile now."
"Stop," Dewey Dell says. "I got to go to the bushes." Pa stops in the middle of the road and we watch Dewey Dell descend, carrying the package. She does not look back.
"Why not leave your cakes here?" I say. "We'll watch 'em."
She descends steadily, not looking at us.
"How would she know where to go if she waited till we get to town?"
Vardaman says.
"Where would you go to do it in town, Dewey Dell?"
She lifts the package down and turns and disappears among the trees and undergrowth.
"Don't be no longer than you can help," Pa says. "We ain't got no time to waste."
She does not answer. After a while, we cannot hear her even.
"We ought to done like Armstead and Gillespie said and sent word to town and had it dug and ready," he says.
"Why didn't you?" I say. "You could have telephoned."
"What for?" Jewel says. "Who the hell can't dig a hole in the ground?"
A car comes over the hill. It begins to sound the horn, slowing. It runs along the roadside in low gear, the outside wheels in the ditch, and passes us and goes on. Vardaman watches it until it is out of sight.
"How far is it now, Darl?"
he says. "Not far," I say.
"We ought to done it," Pa says. "I just never wanted to be beholden to none except her flesh and blood." "Who the hell can't dig a damn hole in the ground?"
Jewel says.
"It ain't respectful, talking that way about her grave," Pa says. "You all don't know what it is. You never pure loved her. None of you."
Jewel does not answer. He sits a little stiffly erect, his body arched away from his shirt. His high-colored jaw juts. Dewey Dell returns. We watch her emerge from the bushes, carrying the package, and climb into the wagon. She now wears her Sunday dress, her beads, her shoes and stockings.
"I thought I told you to leave them close to home,"
Pa says. She does not answer, does not look at us. She sets the package in the wagon and gets in. The wagon moves on.
"How many more hills now, Darl?"
Vardaman says. "Just one," I say. "The next one goes right up into town." This hill is red sand, bordered on either hand by Negro cabins. Against the sky ahead, the massed telephone lines run, and the clock on the courthouse lifts among the trees. In the sand, the wheels whisper, as though the very earth would hush our entry. We descend as the hill commences to rise. We follow the wagon, the whispering wheels, passing the cabins where faces come suddenly to the doors, white-eyed. We hear sudden voices, ejaculate. Jewel has been looking from side to side.